I like to joke that there's a really easy way to stop the spread of false news. It's to stop the spread of all news. And that's sort of, it's a reminder that for various reasons as a civil society, we do enjoy information.
From Stanford University and SiriusXM, it's the future of everything. I'm Russ Altman, and today Johan Ugander will tell us about the differences between how true news and false news spread, especially in social networks. It's the future of social media mis- and disinformation. Social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and others have become an important way to spread information. Now, we used to depend on the major networks and their TV and radio affiliates for the news. Now, however, we can often learn about things from friends or friends of friends or friends of friends of friends and so on these social media platforms. I must say, I've noticed that I can often learn more about breaking news events by checking eyewitness reports on Twitter. Eventually, of course, the major news outlets catch up and may eventually have better and more comprehensive information, but the initial situation is often available from tweets. I was once on a delayed flight to Houston, and nobody knew at the counter why the flight was delayed. I was able to use Twitter to figure out that there had been a bomb threat, an evacuation of the terminal we were supposed to be flying into. That was immediately clear from Twitter, and it took quite a while for the gate agent to understand what was going on. Anyway, this spread of information from social media obviously raises many issues. Since the folks providing the information may not be trained journalists, probably aren't, may not be objective, may have an axe to grind, and may be trying to influence people for reasons other than the pure pursuit of truth. In fact, scientists have studied the rate of the spread of news on social media, especially rumors, which are often exciting and novel, and they have found that false news spreads faster than true news. Now, we can all have theories about why that may be, but it's a pretty important piece of, well, true news. It seems important to have people receive true information. I can't even believe I need to say that. As they make decisions about their opinions, their preferences, and their choices. If they're hearing false information, they may make choices that are detrimental to themselves and others, although it is very possible, indeed probable, that the people who are sending around the false information may be benefiting. So, we all have an interest in understanding how information flows and what can be done to give truth a chance when it may be slower and sometimes more boring than false information. I spoke with these issues with Johan Ugander, a professor of management science and engineering at Stanford University. He has studied the spread of information on social media and had interesting things to say. Later in our conversation, we learned about other projects he's pursuing in analyzing large volumes of information to understand complex social systems. But first, the social media. I asked him about the motivation for his work in understanding the speed and path of information spread, both true and false, and how one approaches such studies. Johan, you've studied differences in the rates of spread of information on Facebook and other social media, depending on whether it's true or not true. And you've had some surprising findings. Can you tell us what you did and what did you learn?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of interest over the last 10 years, but particularly after the 2016 election, in understanding how falsehoods spread on social media. To what extent is mainstream media versus social media responsible for all sorts of information, true and not, reaching people? And so there's been some really sort of like large-scale data-driven attempts to shine light on this question. And so the recent work that I've been involved in sort of looks at this large corpus of news that spreads on Twitter. And it tries to sort of take a machine learning perspective and ask, how can we classify true things versus false things? And can we learn anything from the sort of machine learning classifiers that are derived from that?
Based on what you just said, it sounds like you're going to try to determine truth or falsehood, not so much from the actual content of the message, but from the features it has as it flies throughout social media? I'm just asking.
Perfect. So yeah, great. So there's been lots of, it's a multi-method question, right? So some people are looking at the content and using language models. Some people are looking at sort of the psychology of what people react to more carefully. And this the particular lens that we're using in this work is asking, do true things and false things spread differently?
Okay.
So it's pretty plausible to imagine, or it's well known that different things do spread differently. So we know that, and we verify this as part of our work, that things like petitions spread really differently than news, because it has a sort of, news is timely and has a certain dynamic around the fact that it's spreading in a timely manner. But whereas petitions get passed more as sort of a word of mouth process, there's more of a sort of a game of a telephone being played where they tend to spread more person to person as opposed to transmitting through like broadcast hubs. And so there's it's well known, I should have opened with that, it's well known that different things spread differently. And so the question here was, do true things and false things spread differently?
There are certain examples of things that are clearly true and clearly false. And so I just want to take a moment to figure out how do we define truth and falsehood just under the experimental conditions.
That's a central question of this literature. And it's often, some people say, you know, give me a definition of true and false, I will solve the problem for you. Sort of like the entire problem is coming up with a good definition. And so the work that we're, the sort of the line of work that we're contributing to, where we're not the first ones to take this perspective, is to focus on content that's been fact-checked and then determined by fact-checkers to be either true or false.
Okay.
Now, that's a very specific sampling frame. So when you look at content that's been fact-checked, you're typically not looking at sports box scores. You're typically not looking at sort of like obituaries. Nobody's fact-checking an obituary. Well, there can be a sort of like biographical details that could be fact-checked. And I'm sure that somebody has falsely claimed that the Red Sox beat the Yankees. But more broadly, there's sort of some attention being played here just to things that are being fact-checked. So it's when we talk about true news versus false news, I should actually be very specific. And that's an important part of what we were uncovering, is looking at true we'll call it rumors versus false rumors. Something that's sort of rumor-like and enough to raise the suspicions of fact-checkers and then was determined to be true versus rumor-like and then determined to be false. And that's very different than comparing falsehoods versus sports box score, like news stories about sporting events.
Right, but it is very interesting, and I will compliment you on your choice of problem, because those are the ones that are at the edge where you could argue people need the most help.
Sometimes when people find out that these studies are focusing on fact-checked stories, they're like, oh, but that's not what true news looks like. And that's a weird question. But I think it's actually a better question than looking at falsehoods versus all true things. Because then you just get these baseline differences that sports scores have, for example, a different timeliness. People tend not to care about sports scores 3 days ago, whereas news stories still have a certain relevance 3 days later. And so that means that they do spread differently, but for kind of an uninteresting reason. So there was a deliberate attention being paid to kind of like the boundary of truth, sort of like looking at things that are across or not across the line of truth, and asking, does that sort of like flipping that single bit, does sort of like changing that one thing, change how they spread, that it somehow sort of like spreads more, spreads deeper, spreads broader, these various questions that people have asked.
Great. So, okay, having interrupted you several times, I'm now going to allow you to tell us about the work.
Setting up the question is really important. I mean, that happens in all of science, but sort of like understanding the claims comes down to understanding the question. So the prior work had found that these true versus false rumors, that false rumors spread further. They reach more people, and they also reach, they tend to have a deeper cascade structure. So the cascade structure is sort of like, you can envision a tree that's sort of like spreading out with branches. And sort of like, what does that tree look like? Is it a very tall tree or is it a very broad tree? Is two different ways that trees can be different.
Right.
And sort of at a given, you could ask sort of like, okay, bigger trees are also going to be either taller or broader in some way. And we'll get back to that. But they found that false news was bigger. The trees, the sort of these trees that were growing of information diffusion were bigger, broader in the sense of like the max breadth they were hitting at any given point, how many times they branched. They were deeper, and they were spreading faster, which is a velocity question, which is not quite structural, but it's still sort of metadata associated with the diffusion tree.
Can I think of the leaves of the tree as the recipients of the news? In other words, one branch might be all the people.
Yeah, the people on the inside also received the information, but they also chose to retransmit it. But somehow, like, the leaves and all the little knots inside the tree constitute kind of like the population of people who this reached. Yeah.
And when it's a false news, you found a big bushy tree, and truth so kind the, of yeah. is, I'm asking.
So the prior finding was that there was a attention drawn to this, like an alarm sounded about 2 years ago in 2018, that false news is spreading more. And this was a collaboration with Twitter, and they released this like very rich data that's actually really tricky to analyze. Because you're not sitting with like, oh, this is a group of sort of old people and young people with certain demographics. You're sitting with like a bunch of bushy trees in one hand and a bunch of bushy trees in the other hand, and it's sort of hard to compare them. So what we did in this work that came out this past week was that we were sort of doing more careful matching and saying like, well, let's take all the trees that are exactly of size 100 and compare those in a bunch of structural ways. And that's where we found that, you know, okay, so false news does spread broader. That checked out completely. But we found was when you control for size, false news doesn't look different. The trees don't look different. They're not broader or deeper. Like, they're not more squat or taller. They're sort of spreading in the same way. And then this baseline observation about sort of size just means that there's a higher like elementary velocity would be a speed statement, but like there's an elementary like transmission rate that's higher for false news, but it's not sort of like going through hubs or playing this telephone game in a way that's different than true news.
Huh.
So it was sort of like using matching methods and sort of ways to do treatment control analysis to understand the differences between true and false news.
Yeah, so that is interesting, because if I, just to restate what I think you said,
yes, please.
The tree is I'm thinking about the tree as like the spread of the information that seems to be happening faster, and you confirmed that. But what the tree looks like at the end of a certain period of time is very similar to what it might look like if it was true news.
Right, and the sort of like the alternative hypotheses sort of. Before this work, there was this debate about whether this was a battle on four fronts. Are we trying to sort of make false news smaller, also make it like go less deep, make it go less broad, and make it go less fast? But essentially what we find is it's sort of a battle on one front, that false news just spreads more and has a higher infectiousness. And there's a huge connection, there's a long-standing connection between epidemiological metaphors and sort of the spread of information.
I wanted to ask about
viruses.
That.
Yeah.
So please go for it.
Should
we think about it as an infection, or is that going to be a misleading metaphor?
Yes and no. So I'm a major... information spreads differently than viruses. The main way that information spreads differently is that people are making decisions when they receive information, and there's cognition involved. The epidemiological transmission is about sort of particles landing, and being taken up into your respiratory system, and there's more of like particle system interaction model is pretty accurate. Whereas information sort of, it enters our brain and our brain does miraculous things. We decide whether, oh, this information reached us from two different people. Do I then believe it more? Well, do those people know each other? You're making a whole sort of like, there's a whole social psychology to how information spreads.
Yes.
Whereas when two people cough on you, it doesn't really matter if they knew each other. There's no like, your brain doesn't get to decide whether you get sick. So there are definitely limits. But at a basic level, it's still about a spreading process. So there's a lot of common tools. And rather than saying that sort of like one borrows from the other, I'd rather say that they both use sort of a common basic toolkit. And then there's certain sort of modes of inquiry that are specific to epidemics and the specific information diffusion.
You know, one of the reasons we study epidemiology and spread is because you want to intervene. In the case of viruses, as we all are acutely aware, the idea is to stop the virus from spreading. Now, if you have the goal of stopping a piece of news from spreading, are there lessons from your analysis? And in many ways, I think this is a very germane question because we haven't talked about it, but I presume that one of the motivations of your work is basically the logic that false news is bad or damaging or dangerous, and therefore it would be good to be able to stop it. I could imagine people disagreeing with you on that, and we can talk about that later. But let's say you want to stop information. Do these infectious models for social media give you some ways forward in stopping or slowing the progression of bad ideas?
The first kind of, so I think it's a great question. And I think that it's also a very school of engineering question, because ultimately I think of social media platforms as built systems. And I tend to reject kind of like the naturalist perspective that I'm somehow like David Attenborough watching birds. Like there's a question about how this system was built and could be built. That's sort of first order. So thinking about that, two kind of metaphors that are very front of mind when we've been living in this pandemic are kind of like, oh, well, you know, there's the closure of sporting events, which is sort of like saying that, you know, math super spreader events, we should limit the how widely things spread. And that would be very justified if we felt that false news was spreading more through sort of like high degree retransmission events, or sort of like if it was false news was preferentially finding its way through hubs. But we don't see that to be the case. So you could close down sporting events, which would mean like limiting the distribution of sort of media, major mainstream media accounts, or sort of the size of any given account. But you'd be shutting down false news and true news kind of equally, is sort of the finding. And I like to joke that there's a really easy way to stop the spread of false news. It's to stop the spread of all news.
Yes.
And so it's a reminder that for various reasons, as a civil society, we do enjoy information spreading, and we just want to try and limit certain types of information spreading. So the cutting edge on these types of questions is actually coming. There's psychology work that's more in the lab, and it hasn't quite, you know, hit full sort of generalizability, but there's these very nice studies that are looking at sort of like when you draw people's attention to the accuracy of content, you tend to differentially limit the spread of false information. So for example, the platform design decision that Twitter's made to you're not allowed to, or if you try to retweet content that you haven't read, so you see a news story and you hit retweet, it'll ask you, you haven't read this, are you sure you want to pass this along? So it's a friction that they've added to their product that, you know, everybody who's worked in online platforms knows that these types of, like every click is costly. So this is, you know, goes back to Amazon patenting one click shopping two decades ago.
And you're risking annoying your customer.
You're risking annoying your customer, but they have found it's been validated in lab settings, and then Twitter has adopted it. That sort of like doing that differentially limits the spread of false information, which is sort of like, you know, and those types of product changes, I think, are really important as we started. It's one of our main tools right now, just trying to draw attention to sort of like accuracy and the consequences of your decision, and not necessarily driving frictions to zero, which was the momentum of the last decade, I think.
Yes, and it actually, it's a very optimistic message in some way, which is that trusting people's brains to process something and asking them to do a double check, like a clutch, actually will slow down the transmission of things that are untrue in a way that you would hope would be true. But I think a lot of us have recently abandoned all our intuitions about normal human cognitive behavior because things on, especially those of us of a certain age or older, because so much of it is just so different. This is The Future of Everything with Russ Altman. Coming up next, we discuss a fascinating analysis of millions of pages of transcripts of parole hearings for criminals under consideration for early release. This is about looking for patterns in a text to understand, in this case, how the parole system is working. Next, on SiriusXM Business Radio, Channel 132. Welcome back to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman, and I continue my conversation with Professor Johan Ugander, now focusing on the criminal justice system and the analysis of text. His team had some surprising initial findings about potential inconsistencies across different decision makers in the parole system, and they have a really interesting menu of other analyses planned for the future. I started by asking Johan how he got involved in this project. Johan, we've been talking a little bit about social media, the spread of information, fascinating stuff. But then all of a sudden, I recently learned that you were also looking at the criminal justice system and parole, issues of parole. That was a surprise. So can you tell me, how does a guy like you wind up thinking about the issue of parole? What are the tools that you're using, and what are you finding in that domain?
That work is really fascinating, and I hope that it can be really impactful. So this was work that I got involved with that Nick McEwen, who's a professor over in computer science, has been sort of, this has been a passion project for him for a while. And two, 3 years ago, he recruited one of my PhD students, Jenny Hong, together with one of his own students, Catalin Voss. And essentially, it comes down to the fact that trying to understand the California parole system, focusing on California because it's sort of, there's actually a lot of heterogeneity across states. And it started with a public records request, and then eventually it became a lawsuit that EFF came in, and they got this sort of enormous, enormous corpus of data was handed over to them, which is 35,000 transcripts from parole hearings of people serving life sentences in the California prison system. And the goal has been to try and understand this human process. This is a process where commissioners sit down with prisoners, and there's lawyers and all these sorts of things, sit down for hour-long meetings or often longer, and sort of review a case. And very little structured data exists. It's not something that just sort of is well described by like a bunch of numbers. And so the question was, the goal has been to sort of use something like machine learning to audit these systems, not to replace them at all. That's like a really important basic point. It's using it as a tool for auditing and saying, so looking across many years that we have these 35,000 transcripts and asking sort of like, well, each one is about 150 pages. So that's sort of several million pages. That'd be very hard to read for any human to read. Now, it's not importantly, like this is a computational audit of a human system. So like there already were a bunch of people making decisions, but the goal is to kind of evaluate that system at like a zoomed out level for inconsistencies or arbitrariness. Because it's sort of unstructured data, that's one of the ways that I became involved, because that's sort of my, broadly speaking, so I focus very much on social networks because they're their own particular messiness and sort of their own interesting rich object, but also sort of these large, you know, these 150 page text documents. Then you use tools for natural language processing typically to try and understand sort of like what are the determinants of somebody being granted parole versus not granted parole. How do these things break down by race, by sort of time served, by sex, etc. Even though there was this like initial slightly adversarial relationship over sort of like getting the information released, there's ultimately been a very productive conversation with the California Bureau of Prisons and Parole Board, etc. About sort of trying to, and even with the governor's office. So the ultimately on these types of parole questions, the California governor's office has a certain amount of control to sort of overturn parole decisions, et cetera. And so they are very interested in sort of monitoring the parole process and trying to, you know, increase, release more people, but do so in a sort of societally safe way. Ultimately, I think it's really a like sunlight on a system and helping society see inside something that's been very murky, I think is a useful metaphor for it. Sort of like that helping society see a system that's been very opaque. But then also it's about making recommendations and hopefully in a constructive way, sort of pointing out that, hey, there appear to be sort of like inequities across prisons where there's a lot of very different processes used at different prisons, et cetera. Or the following factors of a case related to sort of like things that might have happened or not happened in prison seem to be surprisingly predictive. We should look further into that. A lot of these claims that we've been able to make are not causal because there's huge amounts of correlations between all the case factors.
Right.
And they've sort of been extracted, you know, how many infractions did the person have during their time in prison? That's something that we've had to extract across 35,000 documents of hundreds of pages. And there's a certain accuracy there and validating that. So it's really that we're trying to introduce that, you know, trying to establish a non-zero value to this perspective of using, doing a computational audit, and then building credibility for that. And then trying to push for working with criminal justice reform groups to try and push for changes.
So just to go back to a little bit into a deeper dive into what you did, you have these 35,000 hearings that you said 150 pages each. You're going to use computers to look at what was said. And I guess you have to make decisions on the topics of interest and then look at, and then when you extract the information, Now you can put it in a structured form so you can look at percentages, like how many of them was there a discussion of X and how many of them was there a discussion of Y, and was that discussion in a positive light or a negative light? So can you tell me what the like big headline topics are that, at least for the first generation, you're looking at?
So there's actually even like basic information that hasn't really been released, that hasn't been released in structured form before. So just if we just look at the information that we can glean from kind of the cover sheets, which structures a little bit, and then you can sort of use basic pattern matching algorithms to extract things. Looking at the grant rates across commissioners. So there's a classic criticism of these types of judicial systems, which is understanding like, are commissioners or judges sort of like, are they all holding people to the same standard? Or how much is your release, how much does it hinge on getting lucky with your commissioner?
Right.
And when those types of questions are asked, it's actually, there's a typical, in the parole setting, there is a strong non-randomness to how commissioners are assigned. So there are certain commissioners that tend to handle cases at sort of supermax level 4 prisons. And it's kind of obvious that they're going to have lower grant rates, even among lifers. And so there's a classic response from sort of the prison side, which is like, well, or sort of from the parole board side, which is, well, you expect heterogeneity because of the differences in the cases they're handling. So one of the things we do, because we're able to extract it from all these hearings, is we look at sort of like, let's look at how do these grant rates stack up? Like, what are the grant rates by the different commissioners? And then what happens if we, this is sort of a computational trick, what happens if we, it's the fancy word is sort of randomization inference. What happens if we shuffle the assignments of commissioners to the cases within a prison within a year? And that controls for the fact that the guidance has changed over time. So sort of like if you were a commissioner who was more active in the past, and then depending on which prison you're active in. And we find that there's a lot of commissioners that are far outside sort of like what their grant rates are outside what you would expect if everybody was following sort of a common threshold.
Yeah, very similar to what we see in medicine when the doctors who are working in very tough specialties have a higher death rate, and it's like, are they bad doctors or are they just dealing with much sicker patients? And you can do similar analyses. So there you have it. Thanks to Johan Ugander. That was the future of social media disinformation and monitoring our parole system. You have been listening to The Future of Everything with Russ Altman on Sirius XM Business Radio, Channel 132.